Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan. Glad to be on the air with all of you. As many of you know, most of my shows, I interview someone who's on the cutting edge of psychiatry, psychology, and all those related areas. But occasionally, I take an hour to talk about things I'm interested in. And today, I thought I'd begin what will become an occasional series on my reform work, the history of my reform work. This is part one. And I want to tell you about how I got to do what I'm doing, because in that process, I can really tell you about what the conditions of psychiatry and psychiatric reform have been like. And I can perhaps best of all explain to you what my deepest convictions are about life and about psychiatry and psychology. Way back in high school, I definitely was interested in psychology, although I had little inclination to think about becoming a psychologist. Some, but not a lot. We're talking about 1950 to 1954. Students in those years weren't supposed to be particularly rebellious, to say the least, or intellectual even. But I was a little bit of both. I certainly was a leader. I was president of my sixth grade class, my seventh grade class, my eighth grade class, my freshman and sophomore years in high school. I was president of the class. And I was vice president my junior year and couldn't run for president my senior year because I was editor of the newspaper, co-editor of the newspaper. But I was always interested in the wider world and reform. I wrote an editorial in high school about the UN and about how important it was for the UN to work towards stopping nuclear proliferation. Certainly an appropriate topic for a young man trying to think about how to relate to the world. And it actually won an award, and I went and read it on The Voice of America way back then. So I had interest in reform, interest in communicating and writing going way, way back. I also was pretty all-around guy. I lettered in track, lettered in football. I had a good social circle. I don't think I felt successful inside myself, nor did I feel particularly happy for reasons way beyond this discussion of my reform work. But I got into Harvard and almost didn't go, so intimidated I was. Came from a small high school on the South Shore of Long Island. We had maybe 130 kids in our class, maybe 500 in school. And I did go. And at Harvard, I certainly felt like the environment was so overwhelming in terms of all these presumably brilliant people and a lot of people with money and a lot of people from prep schools. I didn't envision myself having any kind of a leadership role in that environment. I can't tell you exactly why, but I didn't. And instead, I actually thought that this is going to be finally the chance I have to really be with people at Harvard who were looking for the truth about life and wanted to explore life. I got into an honors program at Harvard in American history and literature. Probably saw myself mostly as becoming a professor. I must say that I was quickly disillusioned about the students at Harvard. They were not truth seekers, not even nearly as much as some of my good friends back in high school, who actually were asking larger questions about life. It seemed to me that the students were split between studying to get ahead and having a social life, but not much using the incredible resources at Harvard to deeply explore what life was about. So I was in my freshman year and studying, doing well, and a friend came by and said, "Peter, you need to do more than study." His name was Michael Doan. He, his brother had just started a volunteer program at a state hospital, Metropolitan State Hospital, and Michael really dragged me out of my room and off to the state mental hospital to volunteer. I don't know exactly what our motivations were. I certainly had some sort of an interest in psychiatry and psychology, although not a particularly a career interest. Got out to the hospital, which was like typical mental hospitals, very old, intimidating looking buildings with cages on the windows, built decades ago, if not more than a century ago. Occasional patients wandering around on a vast grounds. And we were allowed to go visit patients that day on the women's violent ward, which was a locked ward, so there was much walking through wards to get there, with doors opening and shutting with large clanging, a nurse with a big batch of keys, probably an aide, actually, with a big batch of keys, and then onto the ward, which was an incredibly dismal concrete corridor with a few heavy oak pieces of furniture, maybe a couple of chairs, benches, table, a broken TV up out of reach on the wall. There were, in those days, of course, no remote controls, and nobody could get to that TV without standing on a ladder, and it wasn't working. It was a foul-smelling, dismal place. Everybody looked like the wretched of the earth. It was 1954, and the heavy-duty psychiatric drugs, the now called antipsychotic drugs, the then called neuroleptic drugs, the main one in the beginning being Thorazine or Chlorpromazine, not yet inundated the hospital, though in a year or so, practically everyone would be on these drugs. And the place struck me above all else like my Uncle Dutch's description of liberating a concentration camp, an extermination camp in Nazi Germany toward the end of World War II. And the attitudes of the guards and the aides, and eventually I would see some of the doctors, was very similar to things I'd read about the attitudes in the concentration camps, that these were inferior people, defective people. They didn't mind the cold in the winter. They didn't mind the stench, heat, and suffocation in the summer. They were indifferent to their surroundings. Anything could be done to them. Mainly it was a management problem, and there was no hope of progress in their lives. There was no hope of genuine improvement, and certainly little or no hope of anyone ever leaving the facilities. It was a self-fulfilling process. And it was just an overall dismal situation. I got very involved in this. It was as if I had found, and indeed I had found, something that really mattered, something that gave me something worthwhile to do. And the reading I'd been doing in psychology in high school, which was private reading that I did mainly to try to understand what was my own sense of stress and my own sense of personal discomfort was about, and the interest I had in helping people, all of this suddenly became oriented to other human beings in a new and important way. I became the leader of the program in the second and the third year, and we developed quite a large project of several hundred Harvard and Radcliffe undergrad students flooding the institution. Eventually, I sort of stole or kept keys that were given to me. I I just found myself in a position where I wanted to do as much as I could for these people. And one of the things that struck me, and I think that was really different than maybe what some other folks might have felt at the time, I had a sense that there was no great difference between me and these people who were inmates of the hospital. Sure, I was functioning well. Sure, I had a great social veneer. I was very successful by any standard of a young person. But when I saw a woman I was told was a former Radcliffe student, looked like a fairly young person, hiding in a corner, looking disheveled and frightened, I didn't think, what's the matter with her? I thought, this poor human being, whatever happened to her, that this is her condition now. And so I and a bunch of the other volunteers, we reach out to people. Instead of just helping run the dances and helping paint the wards and cleaning the place up and taking some people for walks, I started to make relationships and to reach out to people. And I was just astonished by the humanity, by the degree to which people responded to any little bit of caring we gave them. It was quite a big surprise to me. I learned from the beginning, from before I ever started to take psychology courses or became a pre-medical student, I was learning that what really mattered to human beings was the caring outreach from other human beings, especially human beings in trouble, and these people were desperately in trouble. It also became obvious to me that so-called treatments were doing just so much more harm than good. Now, as the leader of the program, having my own set of keys, I could go anywhere. And I remember going to the shock room where patients were being given insulin coma shock, where they'd be injected with insulin and brought to the verge of death, literally unconsciousness, frothing at the mouth in an insulin-induced coma because it deprived their brains of all nutrients, all sugar, and then seeing them brought back to life by having sugar administered to them. And I saw them come in looking like upset, angry, scared human beings, and then coming out of the insulin coma like docile puppies, grateful to be alive, you know, taking the hand of in a helpless and needy way of the people who were bringing them back to life. And it was so clear to me that what was going on was these people being rendered docile by battery of the brain. Battery of the brain. I remember asking a psychiatrist who was there, how could this possibly help? And he said to me, we're killing bad brain cells. Well, I hadn't been trained, so that sounded like utter nonsense to me. I knew that what was happening to these patients had nothing to do with good or bad brain cells. But before you think that this was really naive and stupid, as an explanation by the psychiatrist, the current biochemical imbalance theory is just the more sophisticated cousin of this idea of killing bad brain cells. There are no biochemical imbalances that we're correcting with these global assaults on the biochemistry that we do with psych drugs. Now, they were also giving electroshock then, and that was just as brutal looking in its own way. And it was clear to me that that was more battery. And I began to read. I got a hold of Walter Freeman's book on lobotomy, and the callousness it showed toward patients and the way it brutalized patients, children, and in private office. He'd get a kid brought to him for an evaluation for being disturbed or angry or difficult to discipline, and he'd offer them an ice pick lobotomy, some 10-year-old right on the spot, and sometimes parents went along with it. And then the way he treated mental patients, it was very obvious that the people he lobotomized, up to 5,000 of them, in state hospitals. He had no respect for us human beings at all. And he wrote about how better off they were with less brain function. Literally, he said they had too much brain function. He even wrote an editorial that got published, as I recall, in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disorders, Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease, I think it was called, and about how patients did better with less intelligence and less brain. What an incredible godlike position, but really the position of the devil, if we want to use proper metaphors. At some point in this program, I went to the superintendent, and I said to him, we've got about 10 students. Those are the most active, 15 students. It was 15. And we each would like actually to have our own patient that we could go visit every week. And we have this nice social worker, Dave Canner, who's willing to supervise us, and we like him, and he likes us, and he's just going to have to give us an hour a week to meet with us in a group, maybe occasionally a little bit more. And at first, there was a lot of resentment, and I ran into my first stepping on the toes of professionals. I really got an angry response from the superintendent. Well, we had already brought so much good publicity to the program. I mean, I don't think we had yet, I'm not sure. I think we'd already actually had a big article in the Saturday Evening Post, which was one of the most popular magazines in the country at the time. I had my picture talking to a patient on the wards, and it just brought a lot of good publicity to this program. I'd been talking about the program around the Northeast at professional conferences, even though I was at that point just a 19-year-old sophomore. And we also met resistance from psychoanalysts, the president of the Boston Psychoanalytic Association, you know, real hotshot psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, said we'd ruin the patients. I'd never seen him or any of his hoity-toity psychoanalysts on the wards of Penn State. Well, we did get our group of patients. I had my own patient who was an older gentleman who was very distressed and fearful and phobic about having a heart attack, although he'd never had one and was afraid to take walks and was living in utter isolation. Well, as it turned out, in the first year, we got 11 of these 15 people out of the hospital, and most of them stayed out. We did it by coming every week and talking to them, and then with a little direction from our social worker, we would visit other facilities, like better nursing homes, not like today's drugging you up and sending you to the nursing home, but better nursing homes in the community. We returned some to their families. My patient got out of the hospital. It was an incredibly successful program. And it led to two things. I came up with the idea for my first book, College Students in a Mental Hospital. We got a good publisher for it. And it went on being written over a 2 or 3 year period after I left. So I'm just one of four authors on the book. And then and Action for Mental Health, which was the President's Commission on Mental Illness and Mental Health in 1962, 4 years after I graduated, was touting this program as one of the hopes of the future. Now, this Action for Mental Health was literally the last dying gasp of psychosocial psychiatry, because in 1962 was a turning point year for psychiatry, realizing it had to make everything medical, that it couldn't compete with psychologists and social workers and marriage and family counselors as therapists because they were better trained and they charged less, that they would have to make everything medical so that everybody would get drugs. It was just beginning to take hold in 62 and 63. Biochemical imbalance theory was about to be promoted by the drug companies. And in this last gasp of psychosocial psychiatry, our program was written up as really one of the hopes for the future. So my whole introduction to psychiatry came out of finding I could really accomplish something, even though I saw the profession needed tremendous reform, that the basic biomedical approach was doing a great deal of harm, I could see that the profession was still examining and looking at psychological, social, and educational alternatives. I was working with professors of psychiatry at Harvard. I was co-authoring a book. We were being covered by national press. None of that could happen today. None of that could happen today. Eventually, the program, after, I think, decades of it being in existence, the program, I even got the program really empowered as a credit seminar at Harvard back in the 50s when students weren't doing things like creating courses. I mean, it was really being accepted, this idea of students with little or no training working as therapeutic aides was really being accepted and embedded in the establishment, but it would not live very long. Because eventually psychiatry would become so polarized into thinking things like schizophrenia is just a disease, you can't talk to schizophrenics anymore, and you can talk to diabetics, and on and on. The irony, of course, was that while medicine in general would become more patient-oriented, and a good endocrinologist or doctor treating diabetics would really encourage their responsibility, encourage lifestyle changes, encourage them to live without medication if they could, to control themselves with healthy living, exercise, diet, and less stress, and so on. Psychiatry, while claiming it was like a medical profession and it had insulin for diabetes, was going to treat patients with none of the person-oriented qualities that you'd see in decent medical care, and in particular, ironically, with this metaphor of insulin for diabetes. Instead, psychiatrists would literally be saying you can't talk to schizophrenia, it's a disease, it's lifelong, they have to be on this drug forever, there's no ifs, ands, or buts. And psychiatry would be becoming more and more a branch of the pharmaceutical industry. So at this point in time, I was still a little uncertain where to go with my career and whether I should become a psychologist. I'd had a very good impression of social workers from the gentleman, Dave Tanner, who worked with us. I didn't respect a lot of what I was seeing in the psychiatry arena, but I was working with some professors that I respected. I didn't fully confront what it meant for them being biological psychiatrists until later on, as I'll tell you, and as I became a reformer in the big arena, they weren't so happy about it anymore. But I called my father on the phone, and because he was going to be paying for med school. I got in at Tufts in Case Western Reserve and chose to go to Tufts, to Case Western Reserve. But I called my dad and I said, Dad, I want to go to medical school, but maybe I could go to clinical psychology school. And I just want to talk to you about it since you'd be paying for it. And my dad, who was a very pragmatic man and spoke very little, he sort of like a psychoanalyst when he spoke, he really listened because it only happened once every several years. But I'd asked him the question, so he asked me one back. He said, Son, who has the stronger trade union? Because I think you're going to want to have a strong trade union behind you. And I said, oh, there's no question who has the strong trade union. It's the medical people, the AMA. That's the strongest trade union. And, of course, the Psychiatric Association, too, kind of a trade union, Dad. And he said, well, you should go to medical school. I'll be able to help you. I'll be able to send you to medical school. And so I made the decision to become a psychiatrist. And by the way, I made it in my second half of my junior year. So it was a rush job to get all those pre-med courses in. I had the very minimum number of the pre-med courses. And I gave up my in-depth studies of American history and literature and took a much simpler program, but a more appropriate one, which doesn't exist anymore, which was social relations, a combination of psychology, sociology, and anthropology, which was very, very relevant to what I really would be learning in the future. Now, med school was very interesting. First, I actually developed a lot of respect for the physicians that were teaching. at Case Western Reserve, they were very, in general, thoughtful people. They were very research-oriented people. They had a lot of concern for the patient. They tended to treat patients with great respect. In retrospect, they were much too much even there in the medical model. But I'm only just learning in the last few years about medicine in general and how much it has strayed from looking at a health, promoting health model, because I've been so focused on psychiatry. But what I was learning in the psychiatry department at Case Western Reserve was appalling. I remember going from a lecture in anatomy where I was taught that students, you may think anatomy is all understood. You may think anatomy is black and white. But let me tell you, we really don't understand the functional analysis of muscles and relationships to nervous function. And we've just got so far to go. We were just getting into the biochemistry of muscle activity. So listen, don't think anatomy is going to be boring. Anatomy is wide open and exciting and interesting. And then I went to psychiatry lectures, and I heard things like ECT is the treatment of choice for depression, and there's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. And ECT is as good now as it was in 1938 when it was first developed. And then I'd go to the psychoanalytic lectures, and I'd hear that Freud was as true today as he was in the early 1900s, and his concepts of psychosocial development were still the truth. And it was just a pretty bizarre thing. Now, I had some wonderful experiences on pediatrics. I almost became a pediatrician. I had the opportunity to work with some outstanding people. My private mentor in the family program for 4 years was Ben Spock, arguably the most famous doctor in the world, Benjamin Spock, the pediatrician. And the main thing I learned working one-on-one with Spock and with the family that I watched go through a pregnancy and helped in the delivery and then worked pediatrically with over 4 years, what I learned from Spock, this most famous doctor in the world, was total respect for this woman and then her baby. There was nothing in him that was not thoughtful and respectful. And that was just confirmed everything I ever believed and was in itself just a marvelous lesson. And I also, you know, met some really great docs in charge of the program on pediatrics. Was Fred Robbins, who was a Nobel Prize winner. He asked me to stay on pediatrics, and I said, no, I think I want to be a psychiatrist, in part because I couldn't bear causing pain to the children, which I always did as a pediatrician in those days. And they wrote recommendations for me for my internship, Spock and Fred Robbins. So I had a good future ahead, I thought, one way or another. And then in 1960, and I thought I'd go off to a big Boston internship. And then something dramatic happened. I read Thomas Szasz's The Myth of Mental Illness in my senior year of medical school. And I also was doing animal research in psychophysiology and publishing papers. Even then, they would be soon published. So these two themes were very interesting to me. We'll go to break now. I got to take a breath and have a drink of water and come back and talk about leaving med school and the changes in psychiatry, which were becoming more and more dramatic. So let's go to break. And this is Peter Bregan, and I'm talking about the origins of my reform work in psychiatry, some of the lessons I got from it, and I had taken you up to medical school. It was very striking to me in medical school, this kind of insane split in psychiatry. On the one hand, electroshock treatment, which was clearly battering patients into submission. It looked obviously like it was causing brain damage because I could see that aftershock treatment patients were brain damaged. So it wasn't very hard to come to that conclusion. I smiled grimly and anxiously about how grossly obvious it is. And patients were delirious after shock. They didn't know where they were going. They'd be led around the ward, couldn't remember much about their lives. They'd have some gradual recovery, but what a trauma and how unlikely that recovery would be complete. And then on the other hand, there was psychoanalysis, lying people down on couches, looking into their childhood. And that clearly seemed to be the preferred form of treatment for the students when they were in trouble. They much preferred to go for psychotherapy than ECT. And then there was this truly bizarre combination of the same thing and the same person. One of the psychiatrists that I worked closely with on my research project over the 4 years, which was in studying the effects of adrenaline given administered to rats and its relationship to how the rats would respond when they had extra adrenaline, how they'd respond to scary situations. By the way, I have really grave doubts about the ethics of that research now in retrospect, and at times I felt queasy during it, but I wasn't ready to really confront that at the time. But one of the men I worked with, I won't bother to name him, was both a psychoanalyst and a huge promoter of shock treatment. Now, the thing that the shock doctors and the analysts had in common was arrogance, certitude, smugness, and authoritarianism, and really a disregard for the patient's viewpoint. Because even in psychoanalysis, it wasn't like a Rogerian psychological therapy where you got people to express themselves and develop themselves. It was a matter of having bizarre theories of the mind through which you then saw your patients through this lens darkly. But at the end of the internship, the medical school, one of my friends gave me a book. He said, "Peter, this sounds a lot like the things you've been saying that have been so angering the psychiatrists." By this fellow, Thomas Zoss. He's a professor in Syracuse, New York. He's the Smith of Mental Illness. And I read it and was stunned that somebody was thinking more deeply about these issues than I had as yet been able to. I was just learning page by page. And there were many things that Zoss was saying that were hugely important. He was saying that to call somebody mentally ill made no sense because it was like talking about a sick joke. Jokes weren't really sick, or a sick economy. Economies aren't sick. And in the same sense, when people are disturbed, upset, angry, nonconforming, rebellious, resentful, it wasn't an illness. It was a viewpoint that they brought to the situation, a response they brought to the situation. Secondly, he was arguing that involuntary treatment was not treatment, it was incarceration. We should get honest that we incarcerate people and that we use this myth of mental illness to justify the incarceration, that they're defective mentally, defective physically. We're doctors, we'll lock them up and treat them. Although, frankly, you can't do that in medicine unless you have a very extreme situation of an individual who has the plague or some other public health high risk. But it was distorted and used to lock up hundreds of thousands of people over the years. And he also spoke of freedom and individuality as being the highest values. So I went up to Syracuse. All the internships had already been developed. I'd sent in mine to the Boston hospitals, and they'd filled their internships already. I met Zoss, I met other people, and they found a space for me. Disappointed somebody else, I only had two spots. And I went to the State University of New York Upstate Medical Center for an internship that included 6 months of psychiatry. Let me take a moment here and just address Tom Zoss. He died this year. Tom was an interesting man. A great deal of his clarity about freedom issues and his clarity in looking at the fact that mental problems were not biological problems came from his lack of connection to people. He was your ultimate libertarian. And for a while, quite a bit after I was working with him, I was for a time very libertarian in my views. Now I'm much more mixed. But Tom literally saw mental illness as fakery. He had no sense of human beings being overwhelmed by emotions, overwhelmed by circumstances, overwhelmed by trauma. To him, they were playing a role like chess. And he didn't see healing as having anything to do with caring. I remember one day sitting with him over lunch with a psychiatric resident who was also his patient, and saying, you know, that I'd read his latest book, which was at the time, The Ethics of Psychoanalysis. And I said, Tom, but, you know, I don't, the problem I see here is that you're viewing it as a game theory. That's what you're saying, and that you teach new strategies and you confront the old strategies. But what about the caring that goes into healing? Well, he gave me no response at all. It was as if I was asking him something from another planet. And his patient, the psychiatric resident, said to me, that's countertransference. That is, that any caring the therapist would have would be an abnormal response to the abnormalities in the patient. He and I continued for the rest of his life to agree on a lot of the freedom issues, but boy, did we diverge on the other issues. And he became very angry at me because I became a reformer who stood up for patient rights. I think his basic view was let them stand up for their own rights. That I actually took on the medical establishment and looked at their medical theories and wrote about their theories, while his viewpoint was you can't argue science with fake scientists. Well, I think the folks out there need to know that it's fake science. No, we don't know that. It's not from a philosophic dissertation, but by a real scientific analysis, which I've done in so many of my books. He very much resented my calling for a ban on lobotomy because he felt that freedom was far more important than whether or not people got lobotomies. And he actually was against what I was doing in that regard. Whereas I saw that by the time a person got to the point where they might be zeroed in on as potential lobotomy victims, they were in no position to defend themselves. They were overwhelmed emotionally. They were generally brutalized and were desperate and were told lies about lobotomy being relatively harmless. And we never told how devastating it was. So I thought the only thing to do in a sane society was to ban it. I came to that very hard because I had these libertarian views, which I still hold, but I differed from him in that. And so we had, by his choice, very little to do with each other. After I finished my training, I went in very different directions. Years later, a mutual friend of ours, when I moved to Ithaca, a friend from the Ithaca area 10 years ago, went and had lunch with Zas, and Zas was astonished that this guy would have lunch with me because I was still talking about love being curative and love being the essence of really of healing. So there was a huge difference there, and Zas did nothing to support the reform work I was doing and, in fact, attacked it on occasion. Because it offended his ideas that you should let people alone to sink, swim by themselves, shouldn't engage fake science with scientific argument, and that freedom was the highest value, if not the only value, and everybody else could just go their own way toward perdition. He actually said that to me on one occasion. I had the opportunity to talk with him about the devastation that was occurring in the psychiatric department at Upstate Medical Center later on, and said to him, this is just horrible. And he said, well, he didn't care as long as he got to write. He literally didn't care what happened to his relationships to other people or what happened to the other people in the department who had supported him and who were being fired as long as he got to write. He said it outright to me. So I had my first year of residency at a very exciting time, I mean, of internship, and it was 6 months in psychiatry at the State University of New York. And then I decided, well, I got to go to Harvard. So I got into the Harvard psychiatric training program and went there 1963, 64. Now, remember what I told you about 1962 being a kind of a pivotal year in psychiatry when it decided to go medical because it couldn't compete with psychologists and social workers, family therapists, and particularly with women. Patients just wanted to go talk to women. Many were women. They preferred talking with women. These women were better trained as therapists than the psychiatrists were. Psychiatry was beginning a process of going broke, which would peak in the early 70s. And so psychiatry is moving in a different direction of let's medicalize. Well, when I got to Harvard, the program had been transformed over a one-year period. It's very important to understand politically. When I applied and got into the program, I was interviewed by a family therapist. I was told that there would be lots of psychotherapy, lots of supervision from very experienced therapists, some of whom I met. I got along really well with these folks. I was looking forward to going to Harvard. I got there, and the program had been changed overnight into a medical model. I was told that as a resident, I could only have one or two psychotherapy patients at the most. I was only supposed to have one supervisor for therapy. I ended up bootlegging supervision, privately seeing extra professors who would help me learn to do therapy, and I ended up having more therapy patients than I was supposedly allowed to have. But I was also forced to do electroshock treatment. I was told I'd be fired if I didn't do it. And the whole emphasis in the program was what I would call anti-intellectual, especially compared to the environment that was around Zoss at the time in Syracuse. Very anti-intellectual. I remember bringing up in a conference where the director of the program was leading our group discussion, and I brought up Carl Rogers. And he actually said to me, Carl Rogers is a psychologist. We'll only discuss the writings of psychiatrists in our clinical conferences. That's how arrogant, ignorant, and narrow-minded psychiatry was becoming. And, of course, not only would they not be reading psychologists, they wouldn't be reading psychoanalytically oriented or psychologically or socially oriented psychiatrists anymore either. And I remember talking to Jerry Clareman, who was the head of the training program and who would later become actually the director of National Institutes of Mental Health and IMH. And I had this open discussion with him, and he said, Peter, you're wrong. You're wrong. Your interests in psychotherapy and in people and in personality theory and in understanding people psychologically, that isn't psychiatry anymore. We are moving psychiatry in the direction of drugs, you probably said pharmacology, and computer diagnosis. Well, we haven't quite made it to computer diagnosis these decades later. We try. We have, you know, means and methods, but no one's particularly relying on it. But I think that's going to happen now, especially going to happen with the national health care that we're going to have and the shortcuts they'll be taking and so on, efficiencies they'll be looking for. And, of course, Clareman was on the cutting edge, and I was not. Psychiatry was going totally in the direction of pharmacology and biological analysis. I was really disillusioned with this, and after a year at the Mass Mental Health Center, which was the main Harvard training program, I told them I was going, much to the dismay of Jack Ewalt, who was the department chair and the same one who had told me not to talk about Carl Rogers in a conference. I told Jack Ewalt I was leaving, and he said, you can't leave. No one's ever left the Harvard program. But I did. I was welcomed back in Syracuse for my second and third year of training. But the department had been devastated. Because of the myth of mental illness being published, Tom Zoss was attacked violently on all sides, from inside the department and outside the department. The commissioner of mental health went to the department and said, we will not allow this man to teach in the main teaching center of your program. It's a state mental hospital facility. The main teaching center was at the time called the Syracuse Psychiatric Hospital, and it was a small, intensive acute treatment center for the state mental hospital system, a great place to train. And they told us he couldn't go there. And the department then started to cut back on his teaching. They tried to get rid of him. He had tenure. He had a big fight. Got to the university professors' organizations on his side. And I watched him, and I learned to fight watching him, because I would soon be fighting as well for my life as you, and identity, as you'll hear down the line as I give you, as I talk to you about the history of the reform work, which is also, I'm hoping, giving you a history of the psychiatry. Well, they couldn't fire Zoss. He held his ground. But they fired everybody who had any association with him. And it was at that time that he told me that that didn't matter to him. Now, I organized residents to defend him, and was fortunate that I did not myself get fired. And I think there were a couple of reasons for that. One was that I was just a resident training. I wasn't a staff member. And secondly, I was really good. I mean, there was no getting around the fact that when they had difficult patients, suicidal patients, that the decision would be made to assign them to me. I was already giving papers at the Grand Rounds as an intern, and then as a resident, I was already getting published. I was doing a good job. I did speak my mind. There was still enough professors they couldn't fire who supported that, the basic viewpoint of looking critically at psychiatry. And so I got through the residency basically unscarred, unscathed, and went out into the world. But what was the world I was going out into? I was fortunate in that I had applied for deferment to get through my psychiatric residency, which meant that I would then agree to go into the service as a psychiatrist. Otherwise, I would have, as it turned out, certainly have been drafted and been sent to Vietnam as a general physician right out of my internship. So it was a good thing that I was able to finish my training and then go into the service. And because I was, although speaking my mind a lot, I was still looked upon as very, very successful. I got the plum of plums and was got into the United States Public Health Service for my service time. Was a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Public Health Service, and then was assigned to the plum of plums, the National Institute of Mental Health, where I would spend the next 2 years. I really liked some of what I was doing at the National Institute of Mental Health. For a time, I was in mental health and education. I was helping develop educational programs, building sound mental health into educational programs. I wasn't skeptical, as I am now, about government programs, although I should have been, seeing the arrogance with which we were planning for things that we knew nothing about and had no way to plan for, except from the off the top of our heads. But it was a good 2 years, and I was asked to stay in the children's section of the National Institute of Mental Health. But I realized, oh my gosh, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be a government person for the rest of my life. But where was I to go? It was clear that psychiatry had been so transformed into a biomedical profession that I wasn't going to be a happy professor at a university, that I would be in constant conflict with the direction of psychiatry. I decided to do something that I never imagined doing, which was ultimately to go into private practice. It became the blessing of my life. It was a default decision. It didn't fit with my ideals of being somebody who would be moving the world in the sense of reforming and doing good and making things move along, making contributions. I thought of private practice as something very different than that, where I'd be helping individuals. And as it turned out, I did a lot of work with couples and families. but I didn't see it as transformative of the world as I'd kind of thought in the back of my mind that maybe I would be wanting to do. But here I was in a profession in which really I no longer agreed with the direction it was in taking. It no longer had a psychological, social wing or a community-oriented wing at all. I had developed a really good private practice. I was quickly had a practice as full as I wanted it to be. And then I was sitting in my office one day in 1971. I was now 2.5 or 3 years out of NIMH. My practice was going well. And I was stunned to discover, stunned to read in a psychiatric newspaper that they were bringing lobotomy back full scale. They'd had a big international conference. They had people doing psychosurgery, some of it with electrodes, some of it with radiation speed, some of it with a scalpel, damaging the front lobes and its connections in the interest of what? Of what? That was one of my first questions. And so I decided that somebody had to finally take a moral and scientific stand against lobotomy. No psychiatrist had ever stood up publicly and said, this is wrong. This is wrong. In fact, one of my greatest mentors who in the volunteer program was also a lobotomist. I hadn't put all that together and started to think about it. So I decided I was going to take this issue on. I thought I'd get support from some big-time psychiatrists. I thought I'd get support maybe from some segments of the American Psychiatric Association. I thought there'd be, you know, well-known figures coming to stand beside me. And it didn't happen. I found myself utterly alone, well, virtually utterly alone in the medical psychiatric community conducting an international campaign, which ultimately was extraordinarily successful, to stop the return of lobotomy and psychosurgery. That will be where I will open with part two of looking at my reform work and the lessons for psychiatry and medicine in general, but I'll end with one lesson. I began to suspect when I was so attacked for criticizing lobotomy, began to suspect that there was a problem in psychiatry that went far deeper than I originally suspected, which is that psychiatry had always, always worked by damaging the brain. That since the 1930s, it had been the whole theme with shock and lobotomy, and then with lobotomizing drugs, the initial antipsychotic drugs, and that the docs who were doing the antipsychotic drugs knew they were lobotomizing agents, and that I was staring at something huge, which if the leaders in psychiatry didn't fully appreciate, they half understood, and they knew they couldn't let this young psychiatrist get away with standing up against a treatment, even one as brutal and bizarre as lobotomy. Thanks for listening. I'm not sure when I will return with part two, the lobotomy, anti-lobotomy campaign, but I will be back next week with another outstanding guest, and I will for the next several weeks be talking with marvelous people in the mental health professions. This is Dr. Peter Bregan. Goodbye.